The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From the record of Master Zhaozhou. One day a student asked, "What about when there is a hair's breadth of difference?" As Zhaozhou said, "Heaven and earth are far removed from each other." The student said, "What about when there is not a hair's breadth of difference?" As Zhaozhou said, "Heaven and earth are far removed from each other." Zhaozhou, as many of you know, was one of the great teachers of the Chan tradition, 8th, 9th century. He lived 120 years. And was, from the records, seemed to have a great affinity for the Faith Mind poem written by Sengtan, who was a very early in the Zen tradition, was a disciple of Hueka, so a direct descendant of Bodhidharma. And this he's drawing from the very opening of that poem: "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything is clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the dis-ease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed." But a dharma is specifically about human life, human experience, human consciousness, human birth and death, human suffering, human liberation. And so our skin feels hot and cold, our tongue tastes salt and bitter, our eyes see large and small forms, our ears hear soft and loud. We move through a universe of beings and creatures and things. We intermingle. We stop to touch and to taste, to listen. We love, we hate. Thoughts arise. Emotions appear. We have sensations. Our mind names things. It describes them and compares them, is pleased with some, displeased with others. Everything appears in all of its different forms. And in all of that, we create ideas, histories are developed, relationships formed and broken, beliefs. And within all of that, we're speaking and acting, creating karma. We can look at someone we've never seen before and feel an attraction, an affinity, a sense of kinship. We can see somebody else and feel just the opposite. It's as though before even meeting them, history already exists. Hundreds and thousands and millions and billions of moments of reactions, of recognizing differences, of having opinions, liking and disliking. This is just sort of reporting on what you hopefully already know. And within it, the mind's essential peace is disturbed. So how is it that our just basic equipment, right, the thing we're born into, this body and mind, all of its circuitry, synapses, neurons, amazing, miraculous, brilliant evolution, consciousness. How does all of that arise into this essential mind's peace is disturbed? Essential here, I think of as, I understand as meaning natural, uncontrived, original, already present. Within all of this, how are we to be free? Because so many of these experiences we have, a label, a description, a comparison, a like, a dislike, a reaction, comes so quickly, it can very easily and convincingly seem that the reaction is caused by the thing we're seeing. Right? This is one of the early, hopefully early revolutions that occurs within the landscape of our mind. We begin to realize that something else is going on. It's not coming from the thing or the place or the person. When we begin studying and we realize the ongoing nature of and creation of the mind, something appears and we have an opinion about it and we build up on that, and suddenly that thing has become much, much larger. And so then we can go to the other side and think, you know, it's all just my mind. It has nothing to do with what's going on. The profound nature of the Buddha's realization is that beginning with delusion, not understanding things that they are, that conditions, in a sense, sets the stage for our consciousness, for our emotions, our thoughts, our reactivity, which sets the stage for our consciousness, which makes it possible and influences profoundly this body and mind, our senses, how we come into contact with things, the desires that arise, our grasping, and what, in summation, the Buddha said is the whole mass of suffering. Well, what is this delusion? In a talk I gave back in the spring, I think, on the there's a collection of short sutras in the Samyutta Nika, the connected discourses of the Buddha, in which Mara visits a handful of the Buddha's nuns who are all practicing in solitude, and he basically harasses each of them, tries to get them to stop, to doubt, to walk away. And so he comes to Sela, who is practicing, and he asks her, by whom was this puppet created? Where is the puppet's maker? Where has the puppet originated? And when and how and where does it cease? And recognizing that it's Mara, she says, this puppet wasn't made by itself, and nor is this sorrow made by another. In dependence on a cause, it comes into play. With the dissolution of the cause, it ceases. Just as a seed grows when planted in a field, because of the soil's nutrients, together with moisture, sun, rain, shade, warmth. In the same way, these aggregates, the elements, our sense media, our senses, the objects of our senses, all in dependence on a cause come into play. In dependence on actions, on what we do with our mind and thoughts and words and actions, it all comes into play, this puppet and the theater. With the dissolution, they cease. What is this dissolution? And so these sensations and reactions and distinctions and opinions and likes and dislikes, they're not all created by you, but nor are they created by the object. The Buddha said, when the bell is struck, when the drum is sounded, does that sound go to your ear? Does your ear go to the sound? Is the sound in the instrument? Or is it in your ear? We have a lifetime of experiences that happen over and over and over and over again. Something appears in a mind, and immediately we want to know, what does it mean? What does this mean? Is that the right question? Is there something beyond meaning? When we see someone on the streets, on the news, in a video clip, screaming, reviling, attacking, calling the police against someone, when that someone is just a person, an ordinary citizen, a stranger, somebody who's shopping for groceries, somebody who's bird watching, somebody who's running to get some exercise, somebody who's protesting peacefully, somebody who's voting, walking down the street with their beloved. When one person is white, one person is black, one person is gay, and one person is straight. One person is Christian, one person is Muslim. What are we seeing? We know what we're seeing, but what are we not seeing? When we see these differences, some of them are visible, but so many of them are not. But we make much of them. What's going on in the mind of anger, of revilement, of hatred, of fear? By whom was this puppet created? And puppet here means a person. But why puppet? Because there can be a sense in which we are reacting. Somebody pulls a string and our arm moves. Pulls another string and words come out. Pulls a string and a fist is raised. By whom was this puppet created? What level of concealment or unawareness or blind faith or uncritical thought or false notions are being manifest? What are we seeing? This is such an important part of practice, such an important part of compassion. You know, the Buddha is said to have been omniscient, to have been able to see beyond the limitations of space and time. But in our own more humble ways, but releasing ourselves from the limitations of all of these constraints, step by step through practice, our vision grows. Our capacity increases to be able to see. It's not that our senses are changing. Something else is changing. Our capacity to see in. We speak of systemic racism, of centuries of patriarchy, of entrenched bias against those of the LGBTQ community, of people of different faiths, people of different class, ethnicity. These systems are also, in a sense, puppets. Who made them? Who's the maker of them? How did they originate? How does it cease? Sela says, just as a seed grows with the proper nutrients, so too it will wither if those nutrients are not supplied. Every person, every word, every action is a result of a seed. And as that action grows and grows and grows, it's because those nutrients are being supplied. So when we speak of causes and conditions being present in every single moment, What are the conditions, what are the nutrients that are being fed into those seeds within ourselves, by ourselves, but also by our environment, our neighborhood, our families, our systems, our country. What is the field from which this puppet appears? And if we think of that puppet as a person, a president, a person with great power, as a technology, as an economy, as a history, something that seems to have the quality of a being, right? We give it a name. It has certain characteristics. We analyze it. We compare it with other beings, with other puppets. Some are born, then they die. Some are strong, some are weak. We can think of history, our education, military, judicial system as various manifestations of a puppet. By whom were they created? Who are these puppets makers? I was listening to an interview with somebody who works, who's a professional poll taker, a pollster. And they were talking about this survey that I looked up because I never heard of it. It's called a Generations and Gender Survey that's done on some regular basis, a very, very sort of highly financed and big deal survey. It's considered to be very, I guess, well regarded. And they do a series of panels and surveys on families, life course trajectories, gender relations, and so on. And they talked about, he talked about how in past years they've seen the sort of deterioration of people's trust in institutions, governments, politicians, science. But then most recently, the more significant and more serious changes they've been seeing is in the drop in trust in each other. People not trusting their neighbors. People in their community. People in their state, in their country, in this world. And it made me think about the importance of trust and faith. You know, what is the level of trust that we have with each other within this Sangha? Because this doesn't work without that trust and faith. But can we think, speak of that in a kind of singular way, right? As though there is a faith, a trust that we have with each other. Well, of course not, right? Because that's something that exists within each one of us. So what is the level of trust each one of us has with each other within a Sangha? And how does that differ? If we think of that as a puppet, something that comes into creation, how does that differ? Who's the maker of that? Well, clearly it's something that exists within each one of us. So we say, well, I'm part of that, but it's not just me. It's not based, it doesn't happen in a void. And what were the nutrients that have gone into developing that trust to whatever it is? The soil of that faith. How is it influenced by our person, how we appear in the world, our race, our gender, our sexual orientation, our class. And what Buddhism is so concerned with is how do we create the right nutrients to bring about those values, those qualities, those virtues that we have, that we possess as human beings, and that we so desperately need. We so rely upon, in fact. And we rely upon them whether we're practitioners or not. Faith is not something that is just a Buddhist thing, obviously. Because as people of the way, we want to know, what are those nutrients that you know, what have I been tilling my soil with that has led me to a life of confusion or distress or sorrow or inflicting of pain? And what are the other nutrients? How do I trust? How do you trust that your practice is true, right? You're doing this, you're investing all of this time and energy into it, reading books about it, listening to talks, practicing meditation. How do you trust that your practice is true, that it's evolving towards awakening? Is it by what you think, the thoughts that you have? Is it by how you talk about it, right? You have sound conversations about it, and that gives you a sense of trust. Or is it by what you do? Is it by how you actually experience yourself living? Having all of those myriad experiences, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, interactions, seeing things arise, what happens next? The faith mind says to set up what you like against what you dislike is the dis-ease of the mind. And so if we, you know, keep sort of appreciating the power of the middle path. So if the path was just like, you know, have no opinion whatsoever, have no judgment about anything ever, right? And you try to control your mind in that way. Well, who knows what's going to, that's going to, if that, I mean, it's not going to turn out well. We know that. But you know what to do, right? You just follow that rule. That's what you do. Or if you just give abandon to your opinions, let them rip. Okay, that's also not going to turn out well, but you know what to do. Right? Your opinions rule. To set up what you like against what you dislike. If we do not understand the deep meaning of things, the mind's essential peace is disturbed. That means when there is a disturbance, something is not clearly understood. We are not understanding something. We are seeing something. We're responding to something. We're feeling something, and we have an understanding of something, but there is something we are not understanding. That's what we want to bring out. And it's not just that our mind is disturbed. This disturbance, if it's not held within mindfulness, within our commitment to cultivating compassion, to living a moral life and practicing the precepts, to caring about others, to examining, self-examination, to illumination and insight, then we know that we're going to be broadcasting that onto others. And we will do that even if we are doing all of those things. In other words, it's not just that our mind is disturbed, everything gets disturbed. It can't be contained. So the student says, what about when there is a hair's breadth of difference? And Zhao Zhou said, heaven and earth are far removed from each other. Things become very distant. And distant now, they stand and they look at each other. And in that remove, all destruction, all violence, all desecration, all oppression is born and is nourished in that remove, in that gap. Those things cannot take place otherwise. They cannot take place otherwise. For someone who cares about that, who is committed to a path of awakening and liberation, that is an extremely significant thing to consider. What are the implications of that? Seeing that remove, how do you come closer? how within the differences do we not separate what is unified? If heaven and earth are fundamentally one nature, Avalokiteshvara realizes the nature of mind. All things have one essential nature. That's what the Buddha was enlightened to. If that's true, then how can it be that heaven and earth are separated? Where are they separated? This is why this is what we are studying in the Dharma. It's what we are studying in our Beyond Fear of Differences work. Beyond Fear of Differences. Right? To pretend, and it's a big pretend, that we don't see the differences, really? Like, how do you control your senses to experience everything the same? Right? That's just a lie. So how do we navigate this world of differences? How do we see them? How do we see them? And so there is a field of nutrients, which is our meditation, is our mindfulness, is our samadhi, is our study, is our reflecting and wrestling with difficult teachings and trying to understand them in relationship to your actual lived experience, to what you see happening everywhere you look. This is why Zazen is so important. This is why it is the direct path. Something arises. You see it. It is this. How do you not set up a single thing? How do you know that it is skillful or not skillful and not set it against the other? Something arises and you try to let your mind rest so that names and narratives and descriptions don't occur, but they occur. You see yourself liking this, not liking that. You experience that. How do you not turn that into the dis-ease of the mind? To recognize where the contraction begins, the body, the heart, the chest, begins to contract, right? Attachments are always a contraction, right? Always narrowing down, like that. And so how do you, in your body and mind, release that? So when we talk about letting go, what is letting go? It's the release of that contraction. And contraction is just another way of describing a kind of confinement. And when we see our minds doing that with others, another. When we see, as we must, what is right and what is wrong. And know the difference. And know the difference because this is causing harm. This in some form is a killing. And this in some form is a living. It's not that complicated. It's not always clear. And it's not always one thing. So seeing right and wrong, seeing what is killing and what is living, and being all about wanting to foster the living and wanting to alleviate the killing, and committing yourself to that, how do you hold no opinion for or against anything? How do you not let your very action that is to bring forth the living, not become an action of killing itself. How do we not become the thing that we're trying to heal? Buddhism has never been about being passive. It's not about not caring. I was talking to somebody recently who was sort of remarking on seeing within themselves how the more, one word we use is detachment, the more detached they were, right? The less entangled, the more they were able to see what was happening and not be so caught in it. The more able they were to have compassion. And I said, you know, that's so important because it's very easy from a distance to look at or hear these teachings and hear them as advocating a kind of remove. Remove yourself from this. To see what is destroying and what is bringing about life and just not set them up against each other. So the student says, well, what about when there is not a hair's breadth of difference? What about when that experience of differences falls away? Because those differences are mind. When we see something, our eyes just see something in and of itself. That's why the Buddha said in the Foundations of Mindfulness, experience your breath in and of itself. A sensation in and of itself, not in relationship to anything, not standing against, alongside, above or below, in and of itself, your mind and mind objects. Because our mind is completely capable of doing that. That's in its nature. It takes practice to return to that, reclaim that. And so how is it when not a hair's breadth of difference arises? Zhao Zhou says, heaven and earth are far removed from each other. How delicious. Right? But wait a minute, that's what he said when there is a hair's breadth difference. Same words. What is he speaking about? What place is he speaking from? This remove is the source of our compassion. Here, there are no conflicts. When there is a hair's breadth of difference and heaven and earth are far removed, there's nothing but, well, there's a whole heap of conflict. I wouldn't say there's nothing but. The whole universe is nothing but the whole universe. Heaven and earth have never been apart, and heaven and earth appear in every moment. Prajnaparamita is realizing this. That's why the great heart of compassion is opened and no one is forsaken. Where would you forsake them to? On the basis of what? You know, when we really examine the basis of our fears, of our differences, if they weren't so profoundly destructive, the source of such incalculable violence and pain and suffering, I would just say they're ridiculous. The bases for which we go to war against each other. All things arise as compassion. If you think of compassion, understand compassion as non-harming. all things arise as non-harming. So think of the world this way. All things arise as compassion. What possibility? So then how do we get rid of our racism, our patriarchy, our gender bias, all of these inequalities, these bases for comparing and judging and putting high and putting low, putting outside, putting inside? Is that the right question? By whom was this puppet created? The Buddha was concerned about getting to the root. Because he didn't want to just alleviate suffering for this moment or this day. He wanted that for his life. He wanted that, actually, for our lives. It's like when we pull back the curtain, who is this wizard sitting there at the controls? And what is it when the puppet is a person, and what is it when it's a institution, right? It's a government. It's a party. It's a group. You know, in a way, for as long as books have been written, you know, there's so much human endeavor has been put into the making of war in all of its various forms, with all of its various weapons. You know, who was it years ago in the Congress who proposed a Department of Peace? I mean, why didn't we think of that? But didn't quite happen. Like the Equal Rights Amendment is still not been passed. And I think when we practice and gain insight into this mind and really just look at it as this collection of skin and bones and flesh and skandhas and thoughts and emotions, you know, just sort of keep your attention contained for a moment, right? As though it's not the world. And just work with your own thoughts, your own emotions. And you see how difficult that is. Right? How many hallways and tunnels and streams and shadows. But there's a legacy of this going back 2,500 years. And then when you take that step further, beyond fear of differences in all things, there is a legacy, but it's not so easy to locate in one place. It's not in, you know, there's not this sort of history that we can go back and directly apply, not as Buddhists. Not examining how to go beyond fear of differences within this place, within our own Sangha, within the imperative of undoing racism in our time. And I really do feel that this is Dada Roshi, you speak of a spiritual imperative. I feel the same way about this. And it's not a different thing that to feel a spiritual imperative that calls us to the Dharma is calling us at the same time to undo racism. And by virtue of that, all forms of bias. And that we cannot see it as otherwise. And not seeing it otherwise, we cannot just agree to that. But we actually have to make it an active part of our lives. In the same way that we can't just agree with the Dharma, yeah, I agree with it, but, you know, I'm not practicing. Well, you can do that. But that's not what we should be about. And so I really want all of us to be doing this work. If we're going to do Dharma practice, then I really want all of us to be doing this work. Individually, but that also is not enough, particularly for white folks. We can't do this individually. We have to do this with each other. We are deluded together. See, that's the thing. We are deluded together, and we are enlightened together. That's the other part of this thing. And in the same way that we can find ourselves in a time of confusion or discouragement or not knowing how to take the next step. You know, I loved where the residents were watching the latter half of the Eyes on the Prize documentary. And there was a point when Dr. King and many others were in Birmingham, and a lot of black folks had been thrown into jail, and they were telling the story of how they didn't know what to do. Dr. King and the SCLC and he said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what the next step is. And they said he went into his room and was quiet for a while, and he came out in his blue jeans and he said, but what I know I can do is go and sit in jail with the people who are there. And I so appreciated hearing that. That in that moment of such a, and within the person of this great person, that there are moments where I don't know what to do next. And so I'll do this. Because that I can do. And the courage of that, because you don't know what happens next. And I think that is how we transform our apathy, disinterest, particularly for those of us who feel unaffected or unoppressed, to see how within this time and place, if we are in an advantaged group, within undoing racism, if we are white, we have to look and see how we are suffering, how we are oppressed within the oppression of racism and white supremacy. Each and every one of us, the Buddha realized, is a person of great wealth. And I think of Dr. King's taking that step. I don't know what to do next, so this is what I'm going to do. That's working from that place of great wealth. You know, and in the moment, it doesn't feel like wealth. It doesn't feel heroic. It doesn't feel significant. It may not even feel smart or worthwhile. But it's one thing I can do. And when we understand that from the perspective of karma, there is power in that, because we understand the power that in one action there is consequence. There's no question about that. And you always know that in the moment that one person is stepping forward, that one place where that consequence is taking place is within that person. That when we actually take a literal step, something moves. There is no question that we have Buddha nature. There is no question that we ultimately seek freedom from fear and violence. There is no question in Buddhism that we have the capacity to love and care for each other, that we have the ability to live our lives selflessly, both before and while we are realizing that. Living selflessly doesn't require realizing selflessness, although realizing selflessness helps us to live it much more abundantly. None of those things are in question. The question only lies in, within all of those certainties, what do we do? What do I do? And not with my precious life, but just today. What is my place of influence? If it's small, work small. If it's big, work big. If it's small and you can make that a little larger, make it larger. When we take one step, something is moving. And the nature of the path is you don't get to know what happens next. In a way, that's not your business. You don't get to find out until you take a step. See, that's the arrangement. That's the way it works. And so that's why I feel we have to do this work together. And that in that way, we are taking not just one step, but many, a multitude of steps. And we don't know where it's going. But we have a pretty good idea of where not taking those steps leads. Knowing that can be very helpful. In the same way that you may not know what's going to happen if you practice the Dharma, but you can be pretty clear on what's going to happen if you don't. Use that. So I'll end with a poem. A hair's breadth difference, and all of the gods and humans and creatures come tumbling in. A hair's breadth difference, and all the world's wonder comes pouring out. All our present sorrow, it breaks the heart. Because all the while, in one such moment, there is an unexpected joy that is yours. That is yours by nature of your arriving here today.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.